Happy Sabbath to all. Today's date is April the 24th, 2015. I welcome you today. I bring to you the eighth study of this series entitled, Why, God, Why? As a preface to the release of today's study title, let me just observe that whenever people challenge God's existence, when they exclaim, if God is real, then why is there so much suffering? In reality, they are expressing that their prayers have not ended their suffering. Quite appropriately, our study is entitled Bottled Prayer Redemption. Let me refer you to Revelation 10. It's only fitting that we do not understand about God. This was by design and by purpose. He did not want you to understand, because had you understood about him, you would therefore not fall under the jurisprudence of the one whom he elected by his governance to enlighten you. But the day is going to come, we're told by the scripture, that the Father will no longer be a mystery. Think about that word, mystery. There are certain things that are mysterious. Before you took math in third grade, it was mysterious how to resolve the problem, what's 2 plus 2? Then the problems of subtraction and multiplication and addition were mysterious. But you learn those things, and I hope you see the parallel of our Christian path, by delving, those of us that were successful, into algebra to help us relate math to resolve more of our mysteries, then geometry, then trigonometry, then calculus. But the day is going to come, just like for the engineering student, as he masters the science of math, the day is going to come when you're going to master the science of God. And that's what John the Revelator is pointing us to, when he exclaims in verse 7, in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, pay close and careful attention. Be reflective as you read. The seventh angel has a voice, not at the beginning of that voice, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel. That has special meaning. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants, the prophets. That gives us, in a brief synopsis, the reality that the blasting of the trumpet is prefigurative of the blasting of a message. It's a voice declared by the seventh angel in a day. What we can garner from this text helps us to understand a point that needs to be emphasized right now. That is, the mystery was never before resolved. It's only resolved in the blasting of the seventh trumpet. Consequently, if you're seeking to garner information about the mystery of God, you cannot attach yourself to former prophetic pronouncements. You can't research the work of Paul. You can't research the work of Peter, James, or John. You can't even research the work of E.G. White or V.T. Hotep. The mystery is not resolved until the blasting of the seventh trumpet. We're going to make a little bit more sense of that as we go deeper into the study. But let me just show you a little bit about the mystery by reflecting back on a text that was cited to you earlier in this series. I'm referring to Hosea chapter 6, approximately in 780 BC. That was nearly 2,800 years ago. The Lord, being frustrated with Israel, expressed what his true intent for them was. And in verse 6 he says, for I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Now, I didn't even think to underscore the concept of mercy, but our study today is going to highlight the Father's mercy. That's what Christ desired. You thought that Christ was a little bit heavy-handed in his dealings with his church, and especially with his dealings with the people that surrounded his church? But yet and still, you misread the Lord even. He wanted mercy. Why did you give mercy? We found out already that Christ, the one whom John 1 tells us was the one who created earth, the solar system, and all those that dwell therein, and in harmony with the Father created man in his own image, we understand that he was not God. This is part of the unfolding of the mystery of God. He was Father's vicegerent. How many times out there relate in the study, he received power of attorney to represent the Father. That was a genius plan in itself. Because the Father knew that in our path to choose the good and refuse the evil, we would, in our immaturity, reject the wisdom and the light and deny the covenants and the contracts and deal treacherously with the Lord and being a manager over a myriad of other beings throughout the universe that were witnessing this great controversy, those who've never partook of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, his reputation would be tarnished by showing them mercy. Well, if you're going to show them mercy, you've got to allow us to have the same. You've got to give Satan and his angels the same. Many would have argued. Therefore, that egregious dilemma that Christ had placed upon himself was effective in preserving the reputation of the Father. But still, Christ expresses his frustration. He says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. He wanted you to know about another person. If he were talking about himself, he'd say the knowledge of me. But he says, what I want you to do is to have the knowledge of God. That explanation suggests to us that the world was ignorant about the Father, that the seventh trumpet had not blasted, and God was held in great mystery. And this was a frustration even to Christ, because he wanted his people to know about the Father. Likewise, let me refer you to John 6. Verse 44 and 45 tells us, no man can come to me. Now I know that you've read this text and other texts like it, and the temptation is to deal with it lightheartedly. But this is a day of strong meat. We have to masticate it carefully. You cannot come to Christ. You can't. No man, he says, can come to me. But I don't believe that because we've been Christians for 2,000 years. Your salvation depends upon you believing the testimony of Jesus. If you can't believe this, if you choose to believe a Constantine's rendition of God, then you think that you know him, that he's the same as Jesus, you have no ability to come to him. He says, no man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. The only day that you have the capacity to come to Christ is the day when Father draws a singular individual. Talk about the single eye. Oh, let us not digress. But no man, except for a single individual, can come to Christ until the Father draws him. And that person does not come to him until the last day. You remember our studies about the last day? We've got a knowledge from reading Genesis about the days. And Genesis is, Adam was told, in the day that you partake of the forbidden fruit, ye shall surely die. Adam partook of that fruit, and it ushered in a proverbial day, a day of death. The first day, death. The second day, death. The third day, death. But the day is going to come. The last day that death shall prevail, whereby Christ is going to raise this person that has been drawn to him, he's going to raise him up. Then he says, it is written in the prophets, they shall all be taught of God. Every man therefore that hath heard and hath learned of the Father cometh unto me. This is why we're here together. Don't complain about the numbers. I told you in prior studies, there's a whole vast array of saints that are seated in Christ's habitation that are rejoicing over this message. But there's only a handful here. They have come to Christ because he's risen up this man in the last day. Therefore, if you're to be taught of God, then there will no longer be attached to his name, his identity, a mystery. People will stop asking, why does God act this way? Why is he so insufferable? You're going to find out, but you can only find out at the last day. I will also show you that based upon the thrust of the first angel's message, it's important to make this a startling announcement. Some people will be shocked to hear it, but you're just learning about the Father. Therefore, it's understandable that you're surprised. But Father has never been personally or directly involved in the affairs of the earth. Never. That's why the first angel's message says, fear God, for the hour of his judgment has come. I told you in prior studies, that's not a message to cause you to be intimidated. It's a message of great relief. The only reason why you're intimidated is because you don't know the Father. You can only envision jolts of lightning as you traverse through the world. But no, there's benefits and graces that are extended to the planet Earth because this is the hour of his judgment. He left in the hands of Christ the ministry to Israel. Then he left in the hands of Jesus the ministry of the Gentiles. And he's pleased that the earth has transported itself through these 6,000 years by all this heavenly energy, and now he has a population that he can save and can grace and bless with the blessing of Abraham. And that blessing can only come in his judgment. We need to stop thinking negatively. We need to stop thinking, well, I feel guilty about certain things. You don't know what to feel guilty about until you receive God's opinion. You need to know that the reason why the tree of knowledge of good and evil was planted in the garden and the reason why you were told not to partake of it was because Father knew that you would get yourself in trouble. He's not an ogre. He's not mean. He knew the possibility that you would violate his laws and his rules, that you would partake of the tree of knowledge of good and evil and set yourself on a path to human degradation. Don't tell me about the Masons and the Illuminati and human sacrifices. All of these things for people that have learned to choose the good and evil, those things represent the evils that would be heaped upon the planet. Because Adam put us on that path, we know that that represents the vestiges of a world devoid of Christ. And the devil has deceived the world to think that such activities are good and has entrapped people, but the Father has a remedy. I just want to communicate the point that his arm is not short, that he can't reach you and pull you out of the mire. And this is why we rejoice in his judgments. The devil has lost the power to cross-examine you. You see that with Joshua, 33rd degree Mason. You know, I'm told that the Hebrew Israelites, I had to do a little bit of research on them. William Crowdy, he was a master Mason. He's the one that started the Hebrew Israelites. Therefore, their officials are enshrouded in not just nakedness, but filthy rags. And this is why the devil stood by Joshua's side and protested against the efforts of the Holy Spirit to enlighten him. And the Holy Spirit said, the Lord rebuke thee, Satan. Is this not a brand plucked out of the fire? In other words, he sinned, but look, he's scorched. He's been burned for his sins. Satan had no idea that the Father's arm could reach that deep into hell and rescue people. So I'm here to explain to you why you misunderstand God and help you to glorify His name as we unfold the mysteries about Him. But I say that He's never been involved in the affairs of this earth. Now, let's clarify that before we move on. Think of a few examples. Remember how you used to go to school? You'd sit in a class, and the teacher would give you instructions. The teacher wasn't the principal. The principal wasn't directly involved. The teacher had power of attorney to represent the principal. The principal honored, you don't argue with the teacher. If you put down on the test 5 times 5 equals 30, the teacher put a B of X on it. And the principal validated the condemnation. Think of your job. Your manager, he is not the owner of the company, but he represents through power of attorney the ownership of the company. Well, I'm going to go over your head. I'm going to complain to the owner. That's a failed strategy. The owner knows that he can't enmesh himself in all the minutiae of the work. He has to delegate responsibilities. Therefore, he is elected a person by his charge to manage your work, to make sure that his company's interests are not jeopardized. That's what I mean when I say the Father has never been directly involved. But we're looking forward to a day when the Father becomes directly involved. He starts by drawing this Son of Man to Christ. That's His direct involvement. In other words, Christ would have said, no man can come unto me unless I draw him. Christ carefully follows the outline that has been presented to him by management, by the owner. No, you don't draw anybody. Keep your identity, your name, a secret. And then I will draw somebody to the understanding of your identity. This is why Peter, typically, remember ancient Peter, 2,000 years ago, this is why he symbolizes those last day work. Because when Christ posed the question, nobody could answer, whom do men say that the Son of Man is? The scholars in that day, some said Elijah, some said John the Baptist. They came with all types. There was ignorance. And if the church was that ignorant, you know that the world was full of ignorances as well also. But Peter stepped up and answered the question, whom do you say that I am? Peter didn't say you're God. He said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. How did Peter get to be so smart? Jesus said, because the Father hath revealed it to you. That shows you that the Father is going to, in the last day, enlighten antitypical Peter the day when he overcomes, the day when he's strengthened, and he will come to Christ. We look at the judgment, and we wonder, as we expand into another dimension of our study, is all of this fair, F-A-I-R? Is it just? As I look at it, some may think, it seems to be a terribly wrong. There are some good people I know that live on the planet today. So therefore, there must have been some good people that lived 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. I can't accept your rendition of the gospel. I can't embrace your concept of a holy Father, a righteous and merciful God, until you can explain to me how these good people are going to be saved. I mean, Christ devoted himself entirely and exclusively, we thought, to Israel. What about the good people, some of them better than Israel, that were in China? And some of them that were in Australia with the Aborigines then. Some of them on different points of the globe. What about them? I mean, that seems to be a fair question. This just shows you the mystery of God. This expresses to you why Christ desires mercy. You know, in the administration of the atonement, you have the mercy seat. Therefore, you would think that some people beyond the reach of Christ and beyond the reach of even Jesus, as he sent the gospel to the Gentiles, would be able to receive access to that seat. We know, by reading John 3:16, it says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. That places a limit, we thought, upon the reach of the Father's mercy. Because how do you know that there weren't some people that lived before Jesus that had an opportunity to witness his life and to hear his truth? How do we know that they would not have accepted his message and received everlasting life? We read these texts and we haven't had the benefit of the answer because we just didn't know the love of the Father. That's the condemnation that the Lord placed upon the Pharisees. We didn't think, imagine how stupid we were. We didn't think that his arm could reach backwards. We thought that he would just discount all of those people of yesterday. And that as a result, only the people today within the span of the Christian gospel. You know, when the gospel was sent to the Gentiles, it wasn't sent through the internet. It wasn't broadcast all over the globe. There was a lot of people that could have possibly and potentially received it. People that were looking for relief from the devil, but they did not have an opportunity. We can ask these questions now because we're beginning to see the mercy of the Father, the wisdom and the justice that he has inculcated into the plan of salvation. Things that we couldn't be taught of by V.T. Hutton and E.G. White because they did not have the benefit of living in the day of the blast of the seventh trumpet. Therefore, this is going to shock some people. It's going to seem like blasphemy. But what else is new? How many things have I taught over the years that haven't been decried by the simple-minded as being blasphemous? But we as Adventists, today, although we've had a great deal of light, I can say unabashedly that we as Adventists did not understand God's salvation. We didn't. You think about that for a second. Look what David tells us in the Psalms. Chapter 50. I'm pointing you to the Psalms, but you know the Psalms and the promises of the Lord that were conveyed to us through David. The Lord himself affirmed that he would uphold all of those prophecies. He would fulfill them. Therefore, we have added assurance when we read verse 23. Whoso offereth praise glorifieth me, and to him that ordereth his conversation aright, will I show the salvation of God. He could have said, will I show the salvation of me? But this is what the Lord meant in John chapter 6, verse 44 and 45, as it was written in the prophets. He's promising to show the salvation of God. Therefore, although we've been pronounced with the commission to declare the three angels' message, we understand why E.G. White says those themes are going to be revisited with greater clarity because we didn't know the salvation of God. Notice what it says. Whoso offereth praise glorifieth me. There are people that can't offer praise because they don't have light and truth. They can't thank Christ for his work because they can't identify him. They can't pinpoint and extol the virtues of creation because they presume that Jesus created everything. They don't know that Jesus was begotten 4,000 years after creation, and therefore he doesn't want credit for something he didn't do. You can't glorify and offer praise to Christ if you don't understand that he was the one who had power of attorney in the Old Testament. We only know in the church of God, quote unquote, by virtue of what we read from the Old Testament. Therefore it says, whoso offereth praise glorifieth me. You cannot. Now, with offering praise, that speaks to the what? The peace offering. The peace offering is an offering of thanksgiving. You can't do that without Moses' administration. In this case, we're talking about antithetical Moses. Therefore, you cannot offer praise. You cannot glorify God. You can't glorify Christ either. You can't even order your conversation aright. You're talking all type of nonsensical conversation. Therefore, you don't know the salvation of God. So think of that next time you wonder why. Look what God wants to do for us. I'm reading in Revelation chapter 21, verse 4. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. I think that some of us, as we've read this in the past, could not possibly understand it. I know that we couldn't, because we didn't know who God was. This is the Father's involvement in earth's management. This is what's going to take place when His judgment is installed. He's going to remove all sorrow and all pain and all crying and all tears. As a consequence, now we can more readily understand why we read about human suffering. Because Father was working to the day when He could become directly involved with the affairs of planet Earth to the glory of the universe, so that they can witness the end of all of these troubles and say, Amen, praise God. But just because you're suffering and you're crying does not mean that it has no benefit. Those of us who have had children know that you don't change the diaper of the crying baby until he's finished relieving himself. Then you take the pains to clean him up, if you're wise. The Father wants to make sure that we have worked out of our system, through the administration of His appointed and anointed, all of the excesses and abuses that we're heaping upon ourselves, that are causing us to cry and to feel pain. Then He's going to step up and clean us up. This is the reason for His judgment. Therefore, since we did not know of the salvation of the Father, understand the atonement scene. We've spent a lot of time discussing that in the past. You had the two cherubims whose wings covered the mercy seat. That means the one who delivers mercy, the Father. The only one you can get mercy from is the Father. His identity was covered. But we had no way of understanding atonement, where the world would be made one with God, until we could discern that it was Jesus who was representative of one of the cherubs, Christ is the other, and it was the Father who was representative of the source of mercy, the answer to our prayers, the relief from all our suffering and from all of our sorrows. Therefore, mercy comes through the judgment. You've missed the point if you haven't recognized that. The only thing is that we didn't understand salvation. Therefore, we thought that it could not be extended to good people. We did not see a way, legally or technically, whereby mercy could be extended to, quote-unquote, the non-believers throughout the ages. But if we had read a little more carefully, we still wouldn't have understood it. But because those of us who read carefully are familiar with the scriptures, now we can open them up. Revelation chapter 4, we just can recall that when the judgment scene began, there were 24 elders and there were four beasts that sat around the throne. And we've seen in prior studies that these four beasts represent the Gentiles from all ages. In other words, they were full of eyes before and behind. They span the entirety of earth's history through the different ages in earth's history. That exegesis helps us as we read Revelation chapter 5, verses 5 through 10. And one of the elders said unto me, Weep not. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loosen the seven seals thereof. We could have read earlier where there was a book in the Father's hand, and no man in heaven and in earth, no one could take the book out of his hands or open it. It was sealed with seven seals. That made John perplexed. He wept because he thought there was no possibility of salvation. He didn't understand the mercy of God. How could he have, when it's only being revealed today? And I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne, and in the midst of the four beasts, and in the midst of the elders, stood a lamb as it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent forth into all the earth. That has special meaning to us now as well. Jesus' sacrifice, we're going to see, reaches forward and backward. And he came and took the book out of the right hand of him that sat upon the throne. And when he had taken the book, the four beasts and 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and golden vials full of odor, which are the prayers of the saints. We're learning about the judgment now. Father had the book in his right hand, sealed with seven seals, we're told. And the four beasts that were standing before the throne, they had something in their hands as well. What did they have in their hands? A golden vial full of odors, which are the prayers of the saints. Odors is the same as incense. And they sung a new song saying, Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God. And by thy blood, out of every kindred, tongue, and people, and nation. It shows you that they were redeemed out of every tongue, kindred, and nation. Therefore, we have solid evidence, once we understand the symbolism, these beasts represent a collection of people from every age. If they were not representatives of all nations that are in heaven, then there would have to be more than four. So each beast represents a collection of people. That's important to understand. And they understand Christology. They've been in heaven learning how salvation comes to them. They give Jesus the credit. Therefore, Jesus' blood covers them. Consequently, their salvation has to come through atonement sacrament. They have been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb, out of every kindred and tongue and people and nations. I want you to focus on the fact, though, that you have two instruments. You have the sealed book and the golden vial. Those are the two instruments that we're going to focus on as we delve deeper into the study. Both benefit from Jesus' shed blood. What does the book represent? The book could only represent the list of church members, the list of those who joined the church throughout the ages. How do we know that? Shortly after Sinai, the Lord revealed this light to us through Moses in Exodus chapter 32, verses 32 and 33. This is Moses speaking. Yet now, if thou wilt forgive their sins, and if not, blot me, I pray thee, out of thy book, which thou hast written. I mean, how much more conclusive can we get? Christ was the one, the scribe, who listed the people who joined in his church. They had to be the people, good and bad, that joined the church, else the sinners wouldn't have occasion to be blotted out. This is verse 33. And the Lord said unto Moses, Whosoever hath sinned against me, him will I blot out of my book. Those people that have sinned against the Lord, they're going to be blotted out, which means that they would have had to come into the knowledge of his standards for them to take occasion to sin against him. There are going to be those who, therefore, as Adventist theology has correctly taught us, whose sins are going to be removed. Therefore, they stand before the Father sinless. Those who retain their sins, and by virtue of the fact that they refuse to heed the message of the trumpet appeal that was blasted to them in their age. They held on to their sins, therefore their names are removed. Thus, when Jesus takes the book, and by the time he finishes his work, you have a roster of the redeemed, not from the Gentile world, not from the non-religious world, not from the world that did not have benefit to his ministry, but from the world that was within the reach of his church. That, I say, represents those whose names are written in the book. But we have two instruments for atonement here now. We have two groups of saints whose prayers are going to be answered. What other blessing could you have petitioned the Lord for? Anything that you ask him for, as your name is recorded in the book, pertains to your prayers to relieve your suffering. Therefore, it would be redundant for their prayers to be included in the vows. Because their names being retained in the book, they receive salvation, which guarantees them an end of human suffering. I would contend with you that those, the people that have been taken to heaven, I can think of Enoch, I can think of Elijah, those are people that we know were attached and associated with the church. But those people from distant lands, whose names we're not aware of, were taken to heaven so that they could not only learn righteousness, but they could examine the deeds of their own countrymen and record their petitions in the vows. That's why the beast hold the vows. It says it's the prayers of the saints. Well, how could they be saints if they're not part of the church? They're saints because they're made saints. That's what this study is designed to show you. But how could this be so? Now, come on, you're stepping out. This is something unheard of in Christology. It's unheard of in Christology. Christology meaning knowledge of Christ, master of Christ. It's unheard of in Christology because you don't know of Christ. It says, no man can come to me except the Father leads him, and I will raise him up at the last day. This is why I quote so often references from B.T. Hotham and E.G. White about the emergence of the real Christians. They weren't real Christians then. You're only real Christians when you learn of Christ and you embrace his truth and his testimony. But let us just take a moment here as responsible students to review the intricacies of the judgment and the judgment proceedings. I don't have the opportunity to give you the vast array of studies that you've been focused on and you've garnered a lot of wisdom and knowledge from over the years. It's just that in 1844, based upon the prophecy given to Daniel, the judgment was open. The judgment session began. The book had seven seals. And with the opening of each seal, it represents the seven generations that are listed in the Lord's books that are to be measured in the judgment. That's why it's sealed with seven seals. Now, after each sealing message, what's a sealing message? Sealing message, as declared by Noah, does he come into the ark and be saved? No, you're crazy, old man. It's not going to rain. It's never rained. Okay, well, then you're going to receive the blast of the trumpet. After each sealing message comes the sealing punishment, the judgment. These events are historical. For example, after Jesus was rejected, the church in Jerusalem was punished. Rome swooped down on Jerusalem and destroyed. It said their blood flowed in the streets. They received the punishment. But let us not be confused. These lessons are exposed before the universe when the judgment is open and the Lord looks backward in time to each generation and examines the sealing message and the pronouncement of judgment, which represents the trumpeted message. That's why John says, he looked forward to things which must be hereafter. Thus, I don't want you to be confused. You're getting the story about the redemption of humanity and salvation as it's articulated through the seven seals. And that's what is indicated by the seven seals were opened, and then the seven trumpets were blasted. Hopefully, that's giving you some clarity. But the seven seals, you need to understand, cover 6,000 years of human history. As we stated already, the mystery of God is revealed with the blast of the last trumpet. This we know because John 6, as we're going to read, shows us the very seal which exculpates man from the curse of death. Therefore, since men still die, and since they do not understand God, they still ask why. And since life everlasting comes only with the last seal, then the mystery of God must become finished by the time of the blast of the seventh trumpet of the seventh seal. Let's read a familiar text, John chapter 6. And as we read it, I say it's familiar, we're going to update it to commensurate with our study today. Verse 26, 27, 32, and 33, and 34. Jesus had just fed the 5,000. He did so miraculously. He gave them free bread. He fed them with 5 loaves and 2 fish. And there was enough remaining after he fed the 5,000. The disciples were sent to gather up the loaves. Which means it's the duty of the disciples to gather together the truth that the Lord articulated. That's what's representative of the bread. It prefigures the message of Christianity. And thus, at the end of his message, he ascended up. The church crossed the Sea of Tiberias, which we've shown to represent the Catholic age. Then when they got on the other side, the Lord invalidated the bread. The reason why he invalidated the bread was because it was revealed to them proverbially. Thus, for the last 2,000 years, what you've been consuming from Christianity is not the strong meat, but that which has to be invalidated. The Lord says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me, not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat the loaves and were filled." Had they not been filled from that experience, they would have gone home and taken care of their own needs. But they had energy to seek after the Lord because they benefited, and I'm speaking now to the antitype, they had benefited from the 2,000 years of Christology that had been unfolded to them. The Lord said, "Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, for him hath God the Father sealed." This is the Father's agent. He sealed this man. The Lord could have said, "Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which I shall give unto you." He didn't say that. He said, "Which somebody else is going to give unto you. The Son of Man." And we've read from John 6:44 and verse 45 more about that. Because the Father draws the Son of Man to Christ, and Christ raises him up. He's sealed by the Father. Nobody else has been sealed by the Father. It just goes to show you that the Father's involvement in earth begins to take place where he's directly involved. No longer using a vicegerent. He leads this servant to Christ and he seals him. He has to be, therefore, the seventh seal. Because he's the one that brings everlasting life, and since nobody has garnered everlasting life until this hour, then it could not have been a benefit from any of the other previous seals. Therefore, he distributes the meat. He shows you the meaning of the scriptures. He reveals the identity of Christ, of Jesus, and Father. He shows you the identity of Jerusalem. He shocks you by telling you they represent the sons of America's former slaves. He shows you the intricacies of David's kingdom. He shows you the replacement of Solomon's temple and the advancement of the temple that Zerubbabel's hands had laid. He shows you that this proverbial mountain, the mountain of the house of the Lord, is prefigurative of sort of a pyramid. It's a man-made mountain because Zerubbabel laid the foundation. Therefore, as Micah 4 shows you, when the nations ascend up into the mountain, they're making a spiritual sojourn. They're not climbing up to the highest mountain, because it says the mountain of the house of the Lord is going to be exalted above the mountains, and all nations shall flow unto it. Therefore, he represents the single eye. This is not a collection of people. This is a man that sees eye to eye with Christ. And he says, I believe it's Luke chapter 11, that if your eye is single, then your house is full of light. Somebody during the Renaissance, not understanding this principle, capsulized it and put it on the dollar bill. And the devil tried to confuse people by saying, that's the symbol of the Illuminati, symbol of the Mason, symbol of the devil. It's none of those things. Jesus spoke of the light of the single eye and of his mountain. And believe you me, there has never been a currency issued in the history of the world that has had the power of the U.S. dollar. You don't believe me? Let somebody give you a Jamaican dollar, or a Yugoslavian currency, or a Russian ruble, or a Chinese yen, or a Mexican peso. The first thing you're going to say is, what? How much dollars is this worth? That's what you're going to say. The dollar is the blessed standard. It's so blessed. Not because America is great, not because the white man is superior. It's because this is the nation that represents Jesus. They are the ones that are the purveyors of the world's benefits. They represent that tree that Nebuchadnezzar envisioned that brings comfort to the entire earth. I think we're digressing here, because the point is really that these represent the wisdom of the Son of Man, which the Father promised to raise up. He's the distributor of bread. He's the one that's sealed. He is the seventh seal. And those who reject his light and his message are going to fall victim to the vestiges and the punishment that's issued by the seventh trumpet. In fact, it says, as we read in Revelation chapter 10, that it's the voice of the angel that is going to be pronounced. It's a message pronouncing judgment. But we're positive here today. We're glorying in the benefits of the judgment. But there are some folks who are going to turn their backs on it that are going to receive the detriments. Verse 32, verily I say unto you, Moses gave you not that bread from heaven, but my Father giveth you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he which cometh down from heaven and giveth life unto the world. This is the grace and the benefit that we're going to receive in the day when the Son of Man is raised up. Because he reiterates the testimony of Jesus. He affirms that the Father sent the Son. He didn't come down himself and die on Calvary, as commonly mistaught. He sent the Son. He sent Christ. He was the bread to come down from heaven. But you cannot benefit from that meal unless you come in contact with the sealed man. The sealed Son of Man. It's no more than saying the Son of David. The Son that was promised to emerge in the last day, that would descend from David, that would establish the name of the Lord. If you don't understand the name of the Lord, then you can't benefit from the bread that came down from heaven. That's the message there. In fact, this is the will of the Father. I never knew that before. Why didn't anybody tell me that it was my burden to look for this Son of Man who was sealed, that he would extend to me everlasting life? The reason why you didn't know it, it says in verse 39, and this is the Father's will which has sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. There goes that last day again, the day when life everlasting is restored. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Now, you can't see the Son unless he's raised up. Therefore, the Lord, to preclude everybody from falling under this judgment before its time, limits the people that have an opportunity to see and to believe. That's why he says, everyone that seeth the Son and believeth on him, they are the ones that receive the seal, the benefit of the seventh seal. As he's raised up, though, you have to understand that the world, therefore, at this sunrise, will have a responsibility to receive his message and his truth and his light. But we're talking about the censer. I think we have a little bit more to say about that. You remember the censer? Father had the book in his hands. The four beasts had the censers, which represent the prayers of the saints. Let us read Revelation chapter 8, and I'll take you from verses 1 through 5. And when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of a half an hour. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. Verse 3, and another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. And there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, you have to be familiar with atonement theology here to fully appreciate this. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. So the smoke ascended before God. And somebody is thinking, now, well, what good does it do? What's the benefit? This is taking place in heaven. These prayers are ascended up before God. We know that they contain the prayers of the saints. This gives Father an opportunity now to answer their prayers. That's why the smoke of these censers ascend before the Father. And not before Jesus, before Christ. They ascend before the Father. So something's got to happen. Now, his mercy has to be exported to planet Earth. For his judgments of salvation and of resurrection to benefit the planet. They have to be transported to Earth for those who have been deceased throughout all generations, but have been praying to the people whom they thought were their righteous leader, looking for redress and for relief. Those prayers have to be answered. Don't lament to me that you've been praying to God and haven't gotten an answer. You haven't gotten an answer because it hasn't ascended up before the Father yet. The prayers of the saints have not reached the ear of the Almighty, because it was designed to reach his ear by judgment and atonement protocol. And when it does, you rejoice and you'll have all your sadness and sorrows cleared up and wiped away. But those blessings have to be delivered to planet Earth, don't they? Verse 5. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it unto the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. So this is Father's involvement on planet Earth. The angel takes the censers. Now, the prayers have been honored by the Father. Now it's time for somebody to adjudicate these saints as they're resurrected and to integrate them into the kingdom. That can only happen when the incense is mixed with the ember from the altar. When the Son of David is united with Joshua, just as ancient Moses was united with Aaron. Then the people, the saints, who were not affiliated with the church, will have their opportunity for atonement. It's cast to the earth, because that shows you now what we've learned in Genesis. You're looking for Genesis? It's the first book. I know you're in the last book of the Bible, but this was preached and taught to us from the first book. We're in Genesis chapter 32, verse 24. Jacob was wrestling with the angel at Peniel, a symbol of male power. And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaketh." And he said, "I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." And he said unto him, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." That point is today to the day of Jacob's empowerment. It's not referring to literal Jacob, but it's the blessing of Abraham that's intended to bless the nations. And it descends through Jacob's son, Judah, and through his posterity to the last day, to the eternal son of David, to emerge. He's given power with God and with man. And this is why the censer is cast to planet Earth. David can examine the cases in the appellate court instigated by the four beasts. "I know this man, he did this, that, and the other." Well, he's got power to give them salvation. But that power cannot come until the censer ordained by the Father is cast down to the planet. That's the day of Jacob's empowerment. What does it mean to have power with God and with man? The angel that wrestled with Jacob was Christ. In Genesis chapter 31, when Jacob says he was the angel of God. Not God. God's involvement on planet Earth only occurs today, the day when we learn of him. This is the point of Jacob wrestling with the angel to receive the blessing. This is how the nations are going to be blessed, because Jacob is given power with God. If you want salvation, regardless of the generation, you have to come to the seed of Jacob to receive your salvation. This is what David meant when he says he will teach us of God's salvation. Back to Revelation chapter 8, he cast the censer to the planet Earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. This is an exact rendering of the Sinai experience. This is the day when Christ communed with his people from the cloud. But it's a day when Christ invisibly rests upon the Son of Man, who's likewise seated on the cloud. That means he's been empowered. The forces of Earth's gravity no longer affect him. And he calls Israel up to the cloud, as we see in Revelation chapter 11. It's a Sinai experience, grandiose. The Sinai experience was given to us for an example of what's going to happen in our day. The earth is going to shake with the son of Jacob. The world is going to be enlightened with his empowerment. And that's why you hear voices and thunderings and lightning and an earthquake. The voice of the disciples indeed is going to be empowered to peal throughout the globe. Everybody is going to watch it. And those who are corrupt, they're going to shake in their boots. But those whose hearts yearn after the Lord, I tell you, see, there are people around the globe that want the Lord. They just haven't had the opportunity to know him. I thank the Father that Jesus' blood, being the sin offering, covers unknown sins. As we bring this study to a close, we see that the beasts represent Gentiles taken to heaven, men like Enoch. On the other hand, the 24 elders represent Hebrews taken there, for they rule the assembly of the saints. They're called elders. At some point, while living in the presence of Christ, all these hundreds, if not thousands of years, these beasts, the ones who possess the censers, men like Nebuchadnezzar, like Prophet Muhammad, like Buddha, like Confucius, and myriads of others whose names we don't know, have had an opportunity to be converted as they witness the conflict of the ages. Our conversion ministry points people to the Word. These people now see the unfolding of the Word, and as a result, they're converted. How did the Lord know which men to take to heaven? You ever wonder that? They had to be men that are conscientious about their own people, because they have to be careful chroniclers of the deeds of those whose hearts are made pure in their land with the standards of knowledge that they have. Nearly 3,000 years ago, he gave us the following answer. Quote, "The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him." That's found in 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 9. There had to be people on the globe, therefore, that had hearts that were perfect towards the Lord. You just were not told about that gospel. You could barely manage the gospel that you were told about. The censer relating to the prayers of their deceased countrymen is cast to the earth. Such symbolizes the need for the house of David. Remember, he has the seal of the Father. He distributes the bread, the strong meat doctrine of Christ. He is prefigurative of the golden censer. So now we have even more reason to explain human suffering under God's administration. It yields humans salvation by atonement ritual. The Lord will be able to see that these people have suffered. They didn't have perfect truth, but their human suffering can contribute to their atonement, as it is adjudicated by the one who has power with God and with man. To have power with man means man comes to you and asks you for grace, and you approach God and appeal to him to extend the grace and the mercy. Hopefully, we've been better educated now about the mystery of God, and we now know better why he has allowed for human suffering all these years. And therefore, as we reflect upon that closing theme, let us bring this study to an end.